Welcome to today's deep dive. If you're joining us right now, you're probably the kind of person who actively seeks to understand the massive kind of invisible gears turning behind the daily headlines.
Right, the people who really want to look past the surface.
Exactly. You are in exactly the right place. Today, we are looking at a mountainous stack of source materials. We've got intelligence briefings, ground-level field reports, global security assessments.
And together, they paint a really vivid and, frankly, a totally fractured picture of our world as of today, March 1, 2026.
Yeah, fractured is the word. Our mission today is to navigate these extreme contrasts with you. We want to extract the underlying currents from all these sources so you can basically shortcut your way to being genuinely well-informed.
It really is a profound split screen we're looking at today.
Yeah.
On one side of the screen, you have these unprecedented, world-altering military escalations that are just consuming all the geopolitical oxygen.
Taking up all the front pages.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But on the other side of that same screen, buried far beneath the fold, you have the quiet, painstaking, and severely underfunded day-to-day work of international peacekeepers.
Who are quite literally trying to hold fragile regions together with, like, duct tape and sheer willpower.
Precisely. And as we walk you through this split screen, there is an incredibly important baseline we need to establish right out of the gate.
Yeah, especially given the gravity of the document sitting right in front of us.
Consider this a crucial disclaimer. The sources we're unpacking today cover highly charged, ongoing military conflicts with immense human stakes. We are specifically talking about actions involving the United States, Israel, Iran, Russia, and Ukraine.
Right.
So we need to make it explicitly clear to you right now. We are not taking sides.
Not at all.
We are not endorsing any geopolitical viewpoints, nor are we making moral judgments on the actors involved. Our sole mission is to impartially unpack the facts and ideas contained in your original source material so you can be fully informed about the reality on the ground.
We are simply the messengers for the data. So, okay, let's unpack this. Because the intelligence that dropped just yesterday, February 28th, 2026, it's the kind of geopolitical earthquake that reshapes entire regions.
It is a massive escalation.
Looking at the briefings, the United States and Israel launched a massive coordinated military campaign against Iran. President Trump is officially classifying this as major combat operations under the banner of Operation Epic Fury.
The specific details of this operation are stark. They really represent a paradigm shift in Middle Eastern security.
Yeah, the targets were, they went right to the top.
They did. The briefings confirmed that the very top tier of Iranian leadership was targeted. Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei was killed in an Israeli airstrike, which was an operation conducted with structural U.S. support.
And it wasn't just him.
No. The strike also killed the Iranian president, the commander of the Revolutionary Guard Corps, and the defense minister. And tragically, state media outlets are also reporting that the Ayatollah's daughter and grandchild were killed in the bombing.
Wait, pause on that for a second. Taking out the Supreme Leader, the president, and the top military brass all at the exact same time.
In one coordinated sweep, yes.
That goes so far beyond a standard military escalation. How does a nation of that size even begin to absorb a sudden complete power vacuum at the very top without the entire region just boiling over?
That is the defining question for global security right now. And the on-the-ground reality is incredibly chaotic. The civilian toll is a major factor in how this is playing out right now.
The numbers coming in are grim.
Very grim. The Iranian Red Crescent Society is currently reporting over 200 people killed in strikes across the country. And perhaps the most devastating data point from the Iranian news agency, RNA, details that a U.S.-Israel strike hit a girls' school.
God.
It resulted in the deaths of at least 53 young students and wounded dozens more.
Which, that guarantees an immediate fierce reaction. The documents show Iran isn't just absorbing this. They are already lashing out.
They are. Iran's foreign ministry vowed a decisive response immediately. And they've already launched retaliatory strikes targeting locations that host U.S. troops across the Middle East.
It's spilling over instantly.
We're seeing reports of incoming fire in the UAE, Qatar, Bahrain, Kuwait, and Jordan.
And while the air defense systems reportedly intercepted a lot of these projectiles, the UAE confirmed that debris from an intercepted missile fell and actually killed an Asian migrant worker.
It is a staggering level of volatility.
It really is. And if you're listening to this, you might be feeling that sense of geopolitical vertigo, because this isn't even the only massive conflict we're tracking today. We just passed a very grim milestone.
The fourth anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine.
Right. On February 24th, 2026, And the statistical reality of a four-year mechanized ground war in Europe is, it's almost difficult to comprehend.
Look at the human cost first. The UN Gender Equality Agency reported that 2025 was the deadliest year of the entire conflict for women.
And then, just look at the logistics of basic survival. The World Food Program notes they have had to provide 3.8 billion meals since the war began.
Just to keep the population fed.
Just to keep them alive.
Yeah.
And economically, the current estimate for Ukraine's reconstruction stands at $588
billion. $588
billion. What that number actually tells us isn't just that war is expensive. It tells us that the economic crater left behind in Eastern Europe is going to require a generational, multinational financial commitment.
Absolutely.
And looking at the state of global diplomacy in these notes, I'm really not sure the current international system is equipped to handle that.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, you start to see a profound diplomatic paralysis.
How so?
Well, to mark the fourth anniversary of the war, the UN General Assembly held a vote demanding an immediate, full, and unconditional ceasefire in Ukraine.
And it passed, right?
It passed overwhelmingly. 107 nations voted in favor, 12 against, and 51 abstained. But, and this is the critical part, the General Assembly's votes are largely symbolic.
Because they don't have the teeth to enforce it.
Exactly. The UN Security Council, which is the actual body endowed with the legal authority to maintain international peace, remains entirely deadlocked. They are completely unable to pass binding resolutions.
If you're listening to this and wondering why the UN doesn't just step in and stop these massive conflicts, you have to understand how broken the actual machinery of the Security Council is right now.
It's a structural failure.
It's like being a passenger in a car hurtling down a mountain and the steering wheel is just permanently locked in place.
That is a highly accurate way to visualize it. And the field notes give us some fascinating insight into the structural root of that paralysis.
There's a memo in here from Pakistan's UN ambassador addressing this exact gridlock, isn't there?
Yes, there is. He points out that the veto power held by the five permanent members, combined with the lobbying by other large nations to get their own permanent seats, is suffocating the institution.
He used some pretty strong language for a diplomat.
He calls it the creation of a larger oligarchy and an elite power club.
To break that down, essentially the ambassador is saying the Security Council has become this exclusive VIP club where a few countries hold the ultimate veto card.
They can just cancel any global action they don't like.
No matter how many other nations support it. So what is his proposed fix? Because handing out more VIP cards obviously just makes the gridlock worse.
His solution is to change the seating arrangement entirely. Instead of granting new permanent seats with veto power, he advocates for longer-term rotating regional seats.
So the power shifts.
Exactly. The logic is that you enhance global representation and actual accountability by rotating power, rather than creating a permanent, untouchable elite class of nations that can paralyze global response at will. This raises an important question. If the traditional UN Security Council model is entirely gridlocked by vetoes, how is the world actually responding to explosive new crises that require immediate boots on the ground?
Well, looking at the briefings, nature abhors a vacuum. Because the UN is stuck, we're seeing the rise of totally new ad hoc coalitions stepping in to fill the void.
The biggest example right now is the newly announced International Stabilization Force.
The ISF for the Gaza Strip.
Right. The structure of this force is a significant departure from traditional models. U.S. General Jasper Jeffers recently announced the composition of this ISF peacekeeping mission, and the troop commitments reflect a very non-traditional alliance.
It really is. I mean, you have forces coming in from Indonesia, Morocco, Kazakhstan, Kosovo, and Albania.
It's an incredibly diverse mix of nations that you wouldn't normally group together.
And General Jeffers specifically noted that Indonesia is going to hold the deputy role for the entire ISF. Also, a quick side note on Kazakhstan. They are seriously stepping up their global footprint right now.
They are. The sources show they are concurrently deploying their third contingent of 139 peacekeepers to the UN mission in the Golan Heights.
So they're definitely expanding their stabilization roles. But bringing the focus back to the Gaza ISF, we have to look at the raw data driving the urgency of this deployment.
The humanitarian need is dire. The medical infrastructure has completely collapsed.
The World Health Organization documents that there are currently over 18,500 patients in Gaza who urgently require medical evacuation.
And that number includes 4,000 children who need specialized treatment to survive. treatment they simply cannot access inside the Strip.
Which makes the deployment of that stabilization force a matter of immediate life and death. But while these brand new, ad hoc coalitions are being duct taped together for Gaza, we also need to look at the traditional peacekeepers who are still out there.
The ones scattered across the globe, trying to manage a dozen other crises.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because when you look at the hundreds of billions of dollars being poured into major combat operations and missiles, and then you look at the bank accounts of the peacekeepers tasked with actually building stability.
The disparity is deeply unsettling.
It's wild. The UN is in the middle of a severe, crippling liquidity crisis.
The financial deficit is staggering when you look at the spreadsheets. Let's look at the UN peacekeeping mission in the Central African Republic, known as MINUSCA. As of early February, that single mission is missing 63% of its annual budget.
63%.
$733 million in assessed contributions remain completely unpaid by member states.
Think about trying to do your job with almost two-thirds of your resources just gone.
It's almost impossible.
And yet, despite running entirely on fumes, that specific mission in the Central African Republic just helped execute the most extensive electoral operations in the country's history.
They managed combined presidential, legislative, regional, and for the first time since 1988, municipal elections.
And the demographic data from those elections is the real victory here.
Women made up over 47% of the registered voters and 45% of the municipal candidates.
That is a monumental achievement for political inclusion in a heavily fractured environment.
It really is. And it highlights a massive theme running through all these documents. Despite being starved for cash, peacekeepers are making tangible, measurable differences on the ground.
Specifically when it comes to protecting and empowering women.
To understand why that focus is so vital, you have to look at the global baseline. According to UN Women, globally, women currently hold only 64% of the legal rights that men possess.
64%.
And if legislative progress continues at its current sluggish pace, it will take 286 years to close that global legal protection gap.
286 years. I want you to just pause and think about that. We are talking about the year 2312, before a woman has the same basic foundational legal protections as a man globally.
It puts the timeline into a very stark perspective.
It makes the urgency of these underfunded missions make total sense. Look at the UN mission in South Sudan. Armed conflict and sexual violence spiked aggressively there in early 2025.
In response, peacekeepers started deploying mobile courts to highly remote areas where residents previously had zero access to any formal justice system.
The impact of bringing the courtroom directly to the conflict zone is immediate. The field reports highlight a specific mobile court deployed to Yei, a city located far from the capital.
Over a short session, they issued 10 formal judgments. 9 of those judgments were for sexual and gender-based violence, and all 9 resulted in criminal convictions.
Which completely changes the calculus for perpetrators who previously operated with total impunity.
It sends a message that the law actually reaches them now.
And it's not just about post-crime justice, right? It's about physical preventative protection.
Yes. There's a note here about Major Swathi, a peacekeeper from India who recently won a UN award for her deployment in Malakal, South Sudan.
She realized that male-only patrols weren't working.
So she initiated frequent mixed-gender patrols. And because of that visible diversity, local women finally felt safe enough to approach the peacekeepers.
They could share their security concerns and actually report violence before it escalated.
We also see this empowerment translating directly into local diplomacy.
Like in the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
Exactly. The UN mission there, MINUSCA, has spent almost 10 years deliberately establishing networks of local women mediators.
Instead of just sending troops to stand between factions, they are training the community to resolve its own conflicts.
The example in the city of Bunia is incredible. They formed something called the Ituri Women's Collective.
These women managed to bring together 36 community leaders to mediate a deeply entrenched land dispute between two historically rival groups, the Lendu and the Hema.
And they actually pulled it off.
They rebuilt enough trust to reopen the Mandra market, which is a vital economic hub that had been completely shuttered by the violence.
They proved that if you give local women the tools to mediate, you get immediate economic recovery.
And there is another highly literal aspect of economic recovery detailed in these reports. You cannot reopen a market or farm a field if the ground is laced with explosives.
Mine action is the physical prerequisite for peace.
It is the literal groundwork. The updates from southern Lebanon are amazing. The UN mission there has a specialized team of Cambodian deminers, and they just officially handed over 5 fully cleared fields back to the Lebanese army.
We're talking about more than 12,000 square meters of land,
where they meticulously unearthed and destroyed 2,173 landmines.
What is particularly inspiring in the demining sector right now is the breaking of historic gender barriers.
Because disposing of advanced explosive ordnance has traditionally been an exclusively male domain.
But the UN Mine Action Service has been actively setting minimum quotas for women's participation. And the results are really shifting cultural paradigms.
I loved reading about Chief Sergeant Laura Christel. She just made history as the very first Central African female deminer.
She is out there in the field working alongside Louisa Diane Nambua, who is the first woman from Benin to qualify in advanced conventional explosive ordnance disposal.
When you think about the psychological impact of their visibility, it is profound.
When a local community sees Chief Sergeant Christel in full Kevlar protective gear, physically clearing landmines from their roads, it sends a powerful message.
It proves to the community that this highly technical, life-saving work isn't just reserved for men, and it isn't just a job for foreign contractors.
It empowers the local population to take ownership of their own security. What's fascinating here is how deeply interconnected all of these global crises actually are. In geopolitical analysis, we use the term spillover to describe how one localized conflict bleeds into neighboring regions.
And the data from the Central African Republic is a perfect case study for that.
Right now, the brutal ongoing war in neighboring Sudan has pushed 11,000 desperate refugees across the border into the CRR.
It's a total domino effect. You have a war in Sudan creating a sudden, massive refugee crisis in the Central African Republic,
which puts immense strain on a peacekeeping mission that we already know is missing 63% of its budget.
And as we look at this cascading instability, it begs the question, what else is missing from the front pages? We've talked a lot about the loud crises, the airstrikes, the elections, the troop deployments.
But there's a whole secondary layer of global instability happening quietly in the shadows.
The reports outline several invisible emergencies. For instance, there is a severely underreported critical food security crisis unfolding right now in Somalia that is struggling to get any international funding or media attention.
Furthermore, a newly published analysis from the UN Office on Drugs and Crime reveals a massive, deeply hidden crisis regarding international waste trafficking.
This part of the intelligence stack was genuinely shocking to read. We are talking about highly organized criminal syndicates trafficking illegal, hazardous waste.
Things like toxic plastics and electronic waste.
Moving it en masse from high-income, developed nations directly into low-income nations.
They are exploiting the global supply chain. These syndicates are shipping the most difficult, expensive, and environmentally hazardous waste to countries that simply lack the infrastructure or regulatory frameworks for safe waste management.
They exploit legislative loopholes and low penalties to run a shadow economy worth billions of dollars.
And in the process, they are causing catastrophic public health and environmental damage to vulnerable populations.
So what does this all mean? We have thrown an immense amount of intense, heavy information at you today.
It's a lot to process.
If you're listening to this sitting in your car or at your desk, it is so easy to be entirely overwhelmed by the sheer scale of Operation Epic Fury or the dizzying $588 billion price tag of a 4-year war in Ukraine.
The massive geopolitical explosions take up all of our mental bandwidth.
But the deeper insight we want you to take away from synthesizing these sources is a new understanding of how genuine stability is actually achieved.
Exactly that.
This deep dive proves that real durable stability isn't something you can build overnight by launching a hypersonic missile at a capital city. True peace isn't an event. It is a painstakingly slow process.
It's structural.
It is built inch by inch by a mobile court delivering long overdue justice in South Sudan. It's built by a Cambodian dominer carefully digging a bomb out of a field in Lebanon so a farmer can finally plant crops again.
It's built by a local woman mediating a bitter land dispute in the Congo so her community can safely reopen a local market.
That is the quiet, essential, foundational work of global security. And right now, it is starving for funding.
To summarize the incredible tension we've explored today, we are observing a global system stretched to its absolute breaking point.
Really?
We live in a world where international peacekeepers are essentially begging for basic funding just to clear minefields and protect vulnerable women, while at the exact same time, major global powers are unilaterally launching massive, multi-billion-dollar combat operations without hesitation.
It is a profound, almost dizzying disconnect. And as we wrap up, we want to leave you with a larger concept to chew on as you go about your day.
Based on the structural decay detailed in these sources, consider this final thought. If the traditional post-World War II institutions, namely the UN Security Council, are entirely paralyzed by vetoes and essentially bankrupt of funding,
right,
while at the same time, major nations feel totally emboldened to unilaterally launch major combat operations, and ad hoc makeshift coalitions are the ones having to step in to stabilize collapsing regions like Gaza, are we currently living through the quiet death of the UN peacekeeping model? And if so, what kind of chaotic or perhaps entirely new world order is going to replace it?
That is a heavy, monumental question. But if you want to understand the next decade of global history, it is exactly the question you need to be asking right now. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We hope this helped you cut through the noise and connect the dots. Keep questioning the headlines you see out there. Always look for the deeper story. And we will catch you next time as we unpack another stack of sources together.